because it was a production class and there were 1,000 numbers, every student was tasked with choreographing 2 to 3 numbers. And I got to choreograph cheek to cheek. I'm very proud of this choreography because I don't think I'm funny as an actor, but here's where I'm like, I'm funny as a director choreographer. So the kid who was singing the lead on that song was pretty tall, like 6'2", 6'3".
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it would be fun to incorporate a lot of the girls who are in the ensemble, because we had like 6 guys and like 20 girls. And so the girls weren't getting enough stage time and it was making me angry. So I put, I think, 6 girls in this number. And every verse, he's dancing with one of them and singing. And I actually had them dancing like cheek to cheek. But after every verse, he would like spin one out and the next one would come in. And they got shorter and shorter as the song went on. So he kept having to crouch down and down. And then finally, by the end, he just picked her up and danced with her.
That is very funny.
I was very proud of that. That was, there were a bunch of things that got cut along the way, a bunch of songs that probably illegally got cut, but that stayed and I was happy about that.
Yeah, that is very funny.
Thank you.
Hello and welcome to It's the Greatest Show, Man, the podcast where we talk about the musicals you love and why they're great and why they suck. I am your host, Brayton the Wheeler, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Emily Chavone.
Hello.
Hello. And happy holidays, / Merry Christmas, / whatever. It is that time of year.
Happy solstice.
Yeah.
Since we're recording on December 21st.
Right. Happy Christmahana Kwanzaa.
And Festivus for the rest of us.
So, yeah.
Yep. It's the holiday special.
All right. Annual holiday special.
Oh, too bad the Star Wars holiday special doesn't count as a musical.
Oh, I know.
That would be fun.
That would be fun. We could talk about it anyway, but it doesn't make sense for us to talk about it on the podcast. But we could talk about it in our personal lives.
Yeah, I don't really want to do that, though.
I don't. That requires me watching it, and I don't want to do that.
I do want to do that and talk about it.
Okay.
Because I think that would be fun.
That would be fun.
Maybe next year.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So, yeah, it is time for our annual holiday-themed episode. And this time we are talking about a real holiday classic, probably one of the oldest, if not the oldest musical we've talked about, White Christmas movie. The movie is old. I don't know if it's the oldest one, though.
Surely we've talked about something older.
This movie's from 1954.
I can't remember all the shows we've covered. Hold, please. Watch me scrolling back through all of our episodes.
Oh, I am too. Don't worry.
Have we really never covered anything before 1954? What an embarrassment.
No, we did Joseph, Company, Big Fish, Bat Boy, Across the Universe, Little Mermaid, Baker Street, Barnum, She Loves Me. Oh, She Loves Me.
No, She Loves Me 61 or 2 or 3.
Hades Town. Greece, the 70s, Maryland.
How have we never covered anything old?
We just haven't. Oh, I don't know.
I'm an embarrassment.
Well, you know, the first step is admitting that there's a problem, right?
Wow. I can't believe we've never covered like old school musical comedy. How was it in 3 years?
We haven't covered a single like golden age musical or like older.
I mean, well, and even like, does Mary Poppins count as a golden age musical?
I mean, I wouldn't say so. I'd say it's a film in the musical. Although, well, I guess similar in the similar case to this one, the movie is older, but the musical is newer, right?
Yeah. Wow. Well, now I'm disappointed in myself. Great way to start the episode.
Well, I'm disappointed in you too.
Hey, one of us picked the Trailer Park Musical.
Yeah, and it was hilarious, and I loved it.
It was stupid, and I hated it.
Oh, I know. That's why I picked it. I also picked Baker Street, and Baker Street was still one of my favorite episodes. So,
Anyway. White Christmas.
White Christmas.
White Christmas is a 21st century American musical based on the 1954 film of the same name. Music and lyrics by my Broadway crush, Irving Berlin. book for the stage show by David Ives and Paul Blake. The stage production first premiered at the Muni in St. Louis in 2000. It's had a bunch of like big regional productions. There were Christmas season tours in the UK from 2006 to 2011. And then it finally made its way to Broadway in November of 2008 and did a limited run for the holiday season. And then repeated that in 2009, both times at the Marquee Theater. And then it's had, you know, some other tours. There was an Australian production.
Yeah.
It was, you know, 50 years old by the time it got a stage adaptation.
Right.
Which is more common than most people think. I think people assume there's a like a book or a stage show and or a play and it gets turned into a movie.
Mm-hmm.
But occasionally, yep, we go backwards and have a movie musical that gets turned into a stage show.
For sure. And, you know, I think that I much prefer this kind of creative track versus like taking something that's not a musical and turning it into a musical. With the exception of like plays. I mean, like taking like films from the 80s or 90s and turning it into a musical. I'd rather they just take a musical film and adapt it to a stage show, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Because I feel like the track record of properties turned into musicals is not as strong. But I don't know if that's true or not.
You're just thinking about Footloose.
I'm thinking about Mrs. Doubtfire and Back to the Future.
Oh.
And Groundhog Day. And.
But there's lots of good ones, though.
Sure.
Everything Lawrence O'Keefe has ever done.
Heathers.
Legally is Blonde.
Great. Yeah, Legally Blonde's good.
Mean Girls was okay.
True. Yeah.
Anyway.
Anyway, to talk about the original film a little bit, it's from, like Emily said, from 1954. Originally directed by Michael Curtis and starring Bing Crosby, Danny Kaye, Rosemary Clooney, and Vera Ellen. Featuring songs by Irving Berlin. It was originally written by Norman Kransa and was with extensive rewrites by Norman Panama and Melvin Frank. Which, the history of the movie is kind of interesting in and of itself, but do we want to focus primarily on the stage version?
I feel like as a theater podcast, we should, but everybody knows the movie, so.
Right, that's for sure.
If you want to talk about the movie, now's your chance.
Well, the thing that I will say is this. I watched the movie and then I watched a stage production and they are similar. They are not the same. The stage version was like pretty heavily rewritten to make it fit more. I'm not really entirely sure. But like some of the story elements are there, but like a lot of it's different.
I feel like it was adapted in a pretty standard way.
Yeah.
For film, like movie musical to stage musical, and the bones are the same, but there's a couple of it didn't bother me at all. And actually when I was writing a summary, I was like, yeah, it's basically the same thing with like, so there are some plot points that are changed. Like in the movie, the girls they're trying to run away from their landlord who,
yeah,
says they owe him money, and then like the sheriff is after them and they jump out the window and Danny Kaye gives them the train tickets and the like, there's all that hijinks, which doesn't happen in the stage show at all.
Right.
They just trick Bing Crosby into getting on the wrong train.
Right. Yeah. Instead of going to Florida, they go to Vermont.
Because that's easier.
Yeah, it is easier. That's true.
And the snoring guy on the train is way more fun than the sheriff eating a bunch of food, I guess.
I guess. I don't know.
The snoring guy on the train honestly really bothered me in the production I watched, so.
Yeah. Yeah, fair enough. I mean, I feel like it's one of those gags that's overused a bit.
I have thoughts. Before we get too far ahead of ourselves, in case for some reason you're listening to this and you don't know White Christmas, maybe stop and go watch White Christmas.
Yeah.
I don't know if you haven't seen it by now, you really don't want to.
The movie's a holiday classic, so.
At time of recording, it's on Amazon Prime Video. Go watch it now.
Yep.
I just, you can't see my face, but like, how have you never seen White Christmas? Anyway, White Christmas follows the story of Bob Wallace and Phil Davis, two World War II veterans who've become successful song and dance duo. After the war, they follow a pair of performing sisters, Betty and Judy Haynes, to a seasonal gig at a rustic inn in Vermont. Upon arrival, they discover the inn is owned by their former commanding officer, General Waverly, who is facing financial ruin because the lack of snow has driven away all the tourists. To save the inn and honor their old friend, the four performers decide to put on a grand musical production, secretly recruiting their old army division to surprise the general and fill the venue, plus all the hijinks of an old school musical comedy. Yay.
Yay. That's much more succinct than the one I wrote, and we're going to go with that one.
Okay.
I got too caught in the weeds a little.
I just wasn't worth it to me. It's like, that's it, basically. There's, you know, the whole bit with, I never remember which one's which, Phil and Judy are trying to get Bob and Betty together.
Yeah.
Because there's a bit in the movie that Phil wants Bob to retire so that he can have a break from performing. And he's like, I'm going to make sure that you marry someone and you have 9 kids. And even if you only spend 5 minutes with each kid per day, that's 45 minutes that I could go do something not with you.
Yeah.
And so like that stayed in the show, but they like keep pushing the two of them to be together in old school musical comedy style.
Right. And in the stage version, Phil is way more of a playboy than in the movie version, which, you know, causes different hijinks, old school musical comedy hijinks. But like, yeah, I mean, at this point, like, not super clear, but I like from the time that they start performing together in the war, and then by the time we see them again before the events of the like. Right at the beginning of the events of the movie, it's been like 10 years.
Yeah.
So they've been performing together for 10 years, which makes more sense now when you think about it, that they're like, Phil's like, I need a break. Because wasn't super clear to me how long they've been doing this. It wasn't until like, I don't remember if it was dialogue or something else that was like, it's in the stage version. They say it's 1954. It's been 10 years.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, okay. They don't say that in the movie, so I was like...
Well, the movie came out in 1954, so I think it's kind of implied, but...
Sure.
It's not explicit.
Right. There's a lot of things that are different because of the time period that it came out.
Such as?
Oh, like, the specific, like, pop culture references and, like, specific songs that are cut from the stage show that were in the original movie. Like, for example, there's a whole number called I'd Rather See a Minstrel Show that is not in the stage version.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I just think because of the connotation of a minstrel show, they just cut it. But there's like, yeah, the movie also has like kind of supercuts of Irving Berlin songs at times. It's like 2 or 3 like in a row that they all kind of mush together.
I mean, he had 1,500 to choose from.
Right. So they just try to cram in a bunch.
Well, maybe not at that point. There weren't 1,500, but... Yeah, fun fact, Irving Berlin, central to the American musical canon.
Mm-hmm.
Like the American songbook.
Yeah, for sure.
Wrote the music and lyrics for about 1,500 songs in his career.
Yeah.
So
that is a fun fact.
And the song White Christmas is still the best-selling single of all time.
Well, there you go.
It smashed the record when it first came out, and it's never been topped.
Yeah.
And that was before there was even like good record keeping in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
When I looked it up, I think it said there was something about Candle in the Wind being up there, but like wasn't even close. It was like 33 million to 50 million.
Wow.
So, and honestly, I'm kind of surprised that it's never been passed, but I guess with streaming.
Yeah.
Like, those things are tracked differently. Because, like, surely the Swifties have done more than White Christmas. Right?
I would assume. But I think maybe is it collectively, like, every version of that song?
No, it's Bing Crosby's White Christmas.
Oh, Bing Crosby's White Christmas.
Like, his recording of White Christmas is the number one selling single of all time.
Well, I mean, I also think he's also just really, really well known for that because he did it twice in 2 different movies.
Well, that's the old school musical comedy. We love this song so much. Let's write a whole movie around it.
Yeah. And they did. Out of curiosity, I did look up the Bing Crosby version of White Christmas. On Spotify, currently, it has 631 million listens or streams.
Yeah.
631,114,256. That's a lot.
It's It's a classic.
It is a classic. And it's been covered a bajillion, gajillion times.
Yeah, but nobody sings that as pretty as Bing Crosby.
You're not wrong.
That was something I was thinking about watching this, is that old school baritone sound. Like the 40s and 50s really loved a baritone and like an alto sound. Mm-hmm. The high voices were not in.
Nope.
Those sultry low voices.
Yep.
Bing Crosby and Rosemary Clooney.
Yeah. Mm. Crooners were very much in back then, so.
Ugh, love it. I was born in the wrong time.
Yeah, you're an old soul.
I know. When I was a kid and I first saw White Christmas, I was like, ah, yes, Betty, that's a role I could play. And if my high school had ever done it, I guarantee you I would have been cast as Betty. That's like 100% my type.
I will admit I have more notes on the movie than on the stage version. Other than like, oh, the stage version is different in these ways. Certain characters are just more prominent in the stage version, like the Martha, the handmaiden. She's not a handmaiden. The secretary or whoever at the hotel desk is more like an Ethel Merman type character. There are some things I thought were kind of interesting, is that in the movie version, they talk about going on the Ed Harrison show.
Mm-hmm.
But in the stage version, they talk about the Ed Sullivan show, because I think that's just recognizable. And at the time, Ed Sullivan, I'm pretty sure, was still alive in the 50s. So they just didn't want to use his name, probably because it would have cost money. They would have had to probably bring him in. Well, the Ed Sullivan show was around in the 60s. Was that
earlier? Ed Sullivan show ran from June 20th, 1948 to March 20th, 1971. So
yes, he was around. But they had like a character that basically was Ed Sullivan. It just wasn't Ed Sullivan in name. Yeah.
Yeah. Ed Harrison.
Yeah. But it's the same. But I'm assuming that like, because if they had said Ed Sullivan, I'm pretty sure they would have had to like actually bring him in and pay him. And they were like, we don't want to do that. You know?
Yeah.
Huh. But for the stage show, Ed Sullivan had died a long time ago. So they're like, oh, we're just going to use this instead, and just kind of updated the stage version. Yeah, a lot of songs were kind of like shifted around, moved around. A lot of songs were added or expanded from the movie to the stage version. They cut the song "Gee, I Wish I Was Back in the Army," but they referenced it at one point in the show, but they don't ever like fully sing that song again. I feel like some of the songs that were cut are probably for the better, like choreography. That song doesn't really fit with the rest of the show. I feel like most of the stuff, I couldn't say most, a lot of the songs I feel like aren't super relevant to the theme of like Christmas, but I think if you had a musical that was just all Christmas songs, you would hate it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Anyway, it would also be the same 12 songs in both acts of the show. So nobody wants that. It is interesting or fun. It is fun for me that some of the songs that are in this show have become like musical theater staples or just holiday staples in general. White Christmas obviously being the major one, but also the song Snow is also, I've heard played on the radio around this time of year. And then Sisters has been done a lot as far as like pieces, like competition pieces and things like that.
Yeah. It's one of those shows or one of those songs that gets lumped in with holiday songs, I think.
Sisters.
Or at least, I don't know if everybody does. I associate it with the holidays because of White Christmas, even though it has nothing to do with the holiday.
Yeah, like favorite things.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
That's fair. That's interesting because like I hear that song and I recognize it in being from this show, but I don't associate it with Christmas.
I only associate it with Christmas because of this show.
Show, right.
Hey, wait, we talked about The Sound of Music. That was the golden age. Whew, I feel better now.
We did. You're right. We did talk about... Yes, we did talk about Sound of Music.
Surely we've talked about a golden age show before. Okay. Yeah. Huh. Still not older than this, but that's fine.
Right.
Okay. Now I can't cut that banter, but...
That's okay.
I feel better. It's been bothering me.
Well, there are a couple, I think, of like, I would say fun facts about the film that I found that I'll just talk about here before we talk about some of the other stuff that you've got on the docket. But what's funny to me is that this song, White Christmas, was first used in a different musical film starring Bill almost said Bill Cosby, starring in a different musical film starring Bing Crosby called Holiday Inn, which is also considered to be a Christmas time classic. Much more controversial than this film. But White Christmas, the song, won an Oscar for Best Original Song from that film in like 1942. And then the movie White Christmas also had a nomination for Best Original Song, but it was Count Your Blessings instead. So it's kind of interesting that like these two Irving Berlin movie musicals each had a different song nominated for Best Original Song, but the first one was the title of the second movie.
Well, that's very typical of the old school musical comedy, like pre-integrated book musical.
Mm-hmm.
And Irving Berlin is one of those like the integrated book musical. Okay, gather your thoughts, Shimon. I consider like musical theater proper to start with Oklahoma in 1943.
Okay.
Because that's the first time really that we can solidify that there were songs that were specifically written to further the plot of a musical. I know other people will argue for other things. Live Your Best Life. But Irving Berlin was writing well before Rodgers and Hammerstein got together and then continued writing after like the scene had kind of shifted to the integrated book musical. So he's kind of this weird vestige of like the old times and also how it kind of like morphed into present. But prior to the musical, like integrated book musical proper, it was really common for composers like Irving Berlin and Cole Porter to just reuse their songs over and over because those were pop songs.
Sure.
And everyone wants to hear that song, White Christmas, again. Well, let's write another show where we can put White Christmas in.
Yeah, more than once.
So, but that's what people want to hear. And then people are going to buy the sheet music and they're going to go home and learn to play it on their piano. And then he's going to get a cut from the sheet music and he's going to get a cut from the film or the stage show or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But like, you can't go on Spotify and stream White Christmas 600 million times.
Right.
Because we just consume media the same way at that point. So it's much more common to see things like that. And there are, I mean, how many? There's at least two Irving Berlin reviews.
Mm-hmm.
There's I Love a Piano and The Melody Lingers On. And I Love a Piano has like 40 or 50 Irving Berlin songs in it.
That's a lot.
And they're all bangers. No, but there are so many songs that are Irving Berlin that I think most people don't recognize as Irving Berlin, at least in 2025.
Sure.
Like White Christmas or God Bless America is Irving Berlin. Did you know that?
I did not know that, no.
The Jewish Russian immigrant wrote the American Songbook. And it's just like, it's reminiscent of this, of a different time that's much more like wholesome and sweet and innocent.
Mm-hmm.
To be like, everyone just wanted so desperately to be a part of it. Like you can tell Irving Berlin desperately wanted to be a part of American culture because he literally wrote the American Songbook.
Mm-hmm.
Was like such a huge part of pop culture. And so like, I don't know. And all of that to say like, yeah, it's super common to reuse a super popular song.
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense to do that. And it's definitely different culturally now, because I feel like if someone were to do that, where they wrote a song that was used in the same film multiple times, like in a musical format, it would get very tiring. I know, like, I will say that it is a little different when you, I mean, actually, now that I'm thinking about it, it's not that weird, because I feel like we kind of get something similar to that, but in a different way, as far as like how many like rock songs are used in the same films over the course of like a decade, right? Like the song, for example, Thunderstruck by AC/DC. How many movies is that song in?
I don't know.
But it's like, that's a lot, right? But I guess it's similar, but not the same in the sense that performers are not singing the songs, I guess. But
yeah, but just the art has changed over time.
Yeah, that too.
Something I was thinking about as I was watching, especially the movie, is how much at that point, 1954, you could get away with. Not like the triple threats weren't quite a thing yet. I feel like West Side Story is kind of where that hit, is like you had to be able to act and sing and dance.
Mm-hmm.
And prior to that, you could, if you could stand there and be a little charismatic, you could get away with not doing all the things. Like, it was such a simpler time, I imagine.
Sure. Well, I mean, like, you bring that up, too, in the sense that Vera Ellen didn't sing anything.
Right, yeah. She's a great dancer.
An incredible dancer. She's
got way better technique than the men.
Yeah.
And then they don't make Rosemary Clooney dance hardly at all.
Right.
But, like, she's, you can tell she's working.
Mm-hmm.
On all the dance numbers, she's also not singing.
Right, she's not singing. It's everything that she sings is dubbed.
And that's just, like, totally acceptable for that mm-hmm. time period.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so many people were dubbed over.
Audrey Hepburn was dubbed over for right. My Fair Lady, and she's the main character in the show.
Right. And it's just like, well, you don't have to be able to do all of it, because we have this technology where we can dub over you.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. We would never allow that to happen now. And in fact, like in more modern film, people like to point out places where it's dubbed. Like the one that keeps popping up for me recently is the Lizzie McGuire movie.
Okay.
Have you seen the clips where if you look it up, there are places where it is dubbed like partway through the song. There's some places where it's definitely Hilary Duff's voice and some places where it's somebody else's voice singing.
Hmm.
And I never noticed it when I was younger, but they'll, like, if someone's got it captioned to be like, this is Hilary Duff, who is this person? Because she's like, we know she can sing.
Yeah.
But now we're pointing all this out like it's a problem, but nobody cares that Vera Ellen was dubbed over. Nobody cares that Audrey Hepburn was dubbed over. It's just like a fact of filmmaking.
It's funny you mentioned that specifically, because now I'm reminded of like the entirety of the first High School Musical film, Zac Efron doesn't sing.
Right. And people are like, oh, he doesn't sing. Like, what's going on here? Like it's a major problem that he as a performer doesn't sing. And he does sing now.
Yeah. He sings everything on his own now, but at the time, for whatever reason, I think it had to do with like his, I think it was had to do with his voice changing, and that was why they dubbed him over.
Maybe, or just like he had no experience singing, and so they felt it was safer to dub him. Like what for whatever reason.
Yeah,
it's been a common practice for a long time, but like it's strange now.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine if someone had dubbed over Hugh Jackman in Greatest Showman?
Only if it was like a really famous opera singer, then I would be like, okay. Like, that's what I want to hear. Some operatic tenor singing. Ladies and gents, this is what we've been waiting for.
No. I don't even want to remember that song.
Someday. We'll talk about it eventually.
But I was actually thinking, when you were talking about, you know, like if a composer put their song in multiple movies, I really feel like Pasek and Paul are the closest that we get to that right now, or maybe Lin-Manuel Miranda. As someone who is a composer who has written songs that are big enough that people would tolerate them being in multiple like pieces of art.
Sure. I would say you're probably right in pitching those particular composers to say like something that they could write that would be in another property that would be popular enough.
I don't know who else could touch that. Unless someone like Taylor Swift was going to write something musical theater.
Sure. Yeah.
But I don't see that happening.
Well, I mean, I think about it like this too. It's like what, and how often do you ever listen to just pop radio or no?
Very rarely.
I'm thinking about it like this, in the sense that musical theater or musical style songs don't really hit the radio that often anymore. I mean, back then, yeah, it was like, yeah, White Christmas was everywhere because it was popular in this film. People liked it, so they played it on the radio. They wrote a second film but had that song in it. And, you know, how many like musical theater staples back then were on the radio because that was the music that people listened to, versus like today, how often do you hear songs from musicals on the radio?
One Night in Bangkok.
Maybe. Though honestly, I'm honestly thinking of Let It Go. Like the Disney song Let It Go. It blew up and was actually on like the radio proper, not just on like Disney radio or whatever.
That's true.
But I think also now that, because music is such a wide, it casts such a wide net, and people want to listen to very specific things. That's why things like Spotify or Apple Radio exist, to listen to your specific niche of music and not just like popular music in general. But that being said, I can't think of any like musical theater songs that have crossed that boundary to get onto like main radio.
Besides like Greatest Showman or La La Land.
But even then, I didn't hear it. I never heard songs from those on the radio proper.
I've heard Greatest Showman on the radio for sure.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Mm-hmm. But then like even thinking about that, Irving Berlin was composing music before the radio existed.
That's also true.
Like yeah. this is how far back we have to go in like what music consumption and pop culture was like. He was writing 125 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
That's wild.
That is pretty wild. And to think that some of the songs that he wrote are still around today is crazy.
Well, yeah, the number one best-selling single of all time.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
I love Irving Berlin so much. I can't, like, when I teach musical theater and we talk about Irving Berlin, I'm always like, okay, remember, it's my Broadway crush, and that'll be a bonus question on the test. But, like, White Christmas was never, like, something super sentimental or special to me. Like, I knew it when I was younger, and I liked it because I like movie musicals or did more when I was a kid. But, like, Irving Berlin, I think part of the reason Irving Berlin's work has lived on so fondly in the American songbook is because of the time period, like, and his style of writing. Because it's different from Rodgers and Hammerstein, which is, like, more metaphorical and flowery. And Irving Berlin is kind of just there. Like, it's not all surface level in the way that, like, Tim Rice kind of writes surface level. Or at least Tim Rice and Andrew Lloyd Webber is very surface level.
Sure, yeah.
Or Richard Stilgoe. But, like, Irving Berlin is writing, and it still conveys emotions and follows, like, musical comedy conventions of the time. But there's, like, hummable melodies and memorable lyrics. Like, a lot of the lyrical rhyming you can do today, it feels... The things that feel overdone or basic is because Irving Berlin was doing it 100 years ago.
Sure.
But everything in it is still, it's like sweet and innocent and like in love and humor and happiness and pretty much everything. It all feels very sweet and innocent to me. Like I always think of the song, Oh, How I Hate to Get Up in the Morning.
I don't think I know that song.
Oh, it's so cute. It's from This is the Army and other things. Okay. But Irving Berlin also wrote a lot of military stuff, which is... Right. Why I think they tie in the military subplot here.
Sure.
Because patriotism, World War II,
mm-hmm.
and wanting to be part of the American culture as an immigrant and an outsider. Anyway, I love Irving Berlin. But Oh, How I Hate to Get Up in the Morning is from the perspective of a soldier who is tired of hearing the bugler wake him up in the morning. And one of the verses is like, someday I'm going to murder the bugler. I'll amputate his reveille and step upon it heavily. And then, like, there's another line that's like, and then I'll get that other pup, the guy who wakes the bugler up, and spend the rest of my life in bed. Like, even the things where we're, like, teetering on, like, oh, I'm going to beat someone up, it's still sweet and funny.
Yeah.
And innocent and, like...
Yeah.
Like, the romance of the time period, I guess, is part of it, too. Like, how deep is the ocean? I didn't realize it was in the stage show, because I know it's not in the movie. Mm-hmm. But I love How Deep is the Ocean. You can tell in Irving Berlin's timeline when he married his first wife and then when she died and then when he met Ellen Mackey and like his life kind of turned around again. You can hear it in his songwriting. Anyway, yeah. I just have a big ugly crush on Irving Berlin.
Well, you know, I will say too that I think because it is all about from the same composer as well, that all the music in the show is just beautiful music. And you could listen to everything on their own because that was kind of how they were designed anyway. So that's really nice. And honestly, it makes me want to just go and find a bunch of Irving Berlin on Spotify and just listen to Irving Berlin just by himself.
It will keep you busy for a really long time because, again, he wrote 1,500 songs, y'all. Right. 1,500. I have this great song in my book from when I was in musical theater auditions class in college, and it was Irving Berlin week, and it was like, pick a song. And I picked a song. It was, I don't know. It's over 100 years old at this point. And the song is called, If You Don't Want My Peaches, You Better Stop Shaking My Tree. And it's exactly what you think it is, but in like the most sweet, wholesome 1917 kind of way.
Well, I will say this. I mean, yes, that does sound very funny. And I remember I've heard that song title before and I thought it was very funny.
But like so humorous, so romantic, like Irving Berlin is everything.
If you go onto Spotify and look up Irving Berlin, it'll give you the top 10 songs.
Uh-huh.
Seven of them are just White Christmas. And then it's seven of them are White Christmas. Then it's Snow. I've Got Love to Keep Me Warm and Happy Holiday. Those are the three.
Is that right now though?
Like right
what's
now.
Most popular right now? Okay, well, yeah. It's December. That makes sense.
I might be overall because I'm looking at everything and everything has like millions of listens or streams or whatever they're called on Spotify. I don't know.
I mean, maybe. I guess his stuff probably comes up around the holidays more than like Putting on the Ritz.
That's by Irving Berlin too?
Mm-hmm. People don't realize that. Or like Blue Skies, I mean, I know it's in the stage show. Is that a movie?
Yeah, very briefly.
I know it's in Holiday Inn also.
Is it?
I think so.
I will admit, I have seen White Christmas more often than I've seen Holiday Inn.
Okay, well, I don't know the movie Holiday Inn as well as I know the stage show.
I gotcha.
Anyway, yeah, Irving Berlin's got so much great music.
Yeah, for sure. Well, something I just want to squeeze in here real fast while there's a little bit of a lull. Another fun fact that I had about this, about the film specifically, is that it was the first film to be released in what Paramount called VistaVision. That basically is just widescreen. It was the first film released in widescreen.
I did see that pop up when I was watching it.
And it also had the highest produced visual quality of the time. So like, you put it on Blu-ray, it still looks kind of grainy. Well, like, well, that's, you can't really push past that. You know, it's
right.
Certain that you're just limited by the what you have at the time. But like, it says that the grainy quality of the film was much, much lower than like anything else that was out there at the time.
Yeah, because they were producing on film that was twice as wide.
Right, right. You know, happy accident, it seems like. But
technology.
Yeah, when technology gets better, so does everything else, usually. I also found some stuff about the original movie, like casting, I thought was kind of funny.
Hmm.
Was that, originally the movie itself was written for Bing Crosby and Fred Astaire, because they had done a bunch of other stuff together. And so it was written for them originally, and then Fred Astaire left the project for whatever reason. And so then they hired Donald O'Connell, who, if you are familiar with Singing in the Rain, he's very famous for that particular film. And then he left the project, and then they brought in Danny Kaye. But Danny Kaye is much more of a comedic actor, so that's why they rewrote the original story to be more comedic, because it wasn't very comedic at first. And they just did a bunch of rewrites to make it funnier. And it definitely still holds up at times. Like, there's moments where, like, this is a good joke. I feel like you also have to just look at it through the lens of the time period a little bit. Because, like, and some of the jokes that did transfer from the movie to the musical are still there. But again, they're funnier if you understand, like, culture at the time.
Yeah, that was something I was struggling with when I was watching, because the stage show I watched was a high school production, and I don't know if it was a product of like just a, it will say, emerging school theater program, or bad direction or what, but none of the jokes land, or very few of the jokes landed, and it just felt like the kids didn't understand the humor,
yeah,
or like what the joke was getting at. And It I mean, that comes from being an inexperienced performer.
Sure.
And being young and trying to play an adult.
Mm-hmm.
But I was disappointed that, like, as a director, I would have had them say lines differently, or like, you know, tried to help them understand the joke, because there were so many jokes I could feel in the script it was meant to be a joke and it just didn't land.
Yeah, and I think that you're right about that as well, that there are a lot of jokes, and they're pretty funny jokes, especially, you know, when you are aware of the context. But yeah, I could see how that would be a little bit of a problem with high school kids, and like not necessarily understanding, like they don't get the joke, so they don't say it like a joke.
Yeah. Or yeah, high school kids who think that a character needs to have only one trait. They're like, well, Rosemary Clooney is bitter, so I'm just going to play this character one note the whole time, instead of providing literally any amount of nuance.
Well, and that, because that's the whole thing, you know, with that character as well. When you really break it down, she's a little bit at times, but not really, you know, it's the nuance.
Yeah. That production also, I mean, so I'm pretty sure they were using tracks. So their orchestra, I'll say in quotes, sounded great. And that supported the kids well. I'm not opposed to using tracks. I think that that's a great tool. And it gives you a lot of bang for your buck. And things like that, like where if you have... I think we've talked about this before, where if you have really nice lighting or really nice costumes and really nice sets, your kids who are performing don't have to do as much work to convince the audience it's a good show. You can trick them into thinking it's a good show by making it look nice. Mm-hmm. And if it always sounds nice because there are no student musicians who can't remember that this is in C sharp major and there are seven sharps they have to play, but only for this like six bars in a row and then the key changes, because that's what happens in a musical theater score.
Mm-hmm.
Like, people hear the sour notes in the pit and go, ugh.
Yeah.
Oh, kids. And they cringe, and that's what they remember or they hear. If you can avoid doing that, then you're just supporting the student performers even more. So that didn't bother me. It seemed like, based on their costuming and sets and stuff, that they had a pretty good amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
So I assume that they're a relatively established program, but it just, everything was so flat. Performance wise.
I felt also, that way as well.
The director is the one who posted it online, which makes me think that that's not a theater person, because guess what, Jim? I don't think you had a video license that said you may post to YouTube for 100,000 people to watch. And while maybe I am part of the problem as the person who watched the video, pretty sure Concord Theatricals does not allow you to post this video online. So, Concord, if you're listening, Jim did a bad thing. He didn't coach his actors and direct them in a way to pull out the jokes. And then he posted it online for all the world to see, including me. So,
yeah.
Jim, if you're listening, do better.
Shame on you, Jim.
Do better, Jim. No, just, but like, I don't know. Also, if your name is Jim, do we know anyone who's younger than Gen X who goes by Jim? Do you know any millennials named Jim?
I don't think I do.
I know millennials named James.
I do too.
I don't know any millennials named Jim, which tells me that Jim's probably a boomer.
You're probably
Jim,
right.
Read your contract. You were alive maybe when White Christmas came out, and you should understand the humor. Teach it to your kids. Those two boys. Look, I want to be an ally. We're in theater. The Alphabet Mafia is here. They're not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. Those were the two gayest high school boys I've ever seen on stage together. At no point were they convincing as two men who were interested in two women. I kept waiting for them to kiss each other.
No, just little pecks on the cheek.
When they did Sisters, I was like, that was the only time it looked like they were having fun.
Yeah.
And I was like, this makes sense. The second you get the sparkly costume in the fan, you're having a great time because you are very gay. And I hope you're having a great life and not listening to this podcast where I shit on your performance as a high schooler.
Yeah.
Come on, Jim. If your two leads can't present as straight. I mean, and like that production got away with some stuff that we would never get away with. Like, did you watch that one or no?
Yeah, I did. I watched the same one.
Yeah, the
Christmas tree costumes?
Yes, the Christmas tree costumes. When those costumes came out, I was like, hello.
I was like, those are some very strategically placed pom-poms you have there.
Ah, yes. Those little bobble ornaments that bobble anytime you move at all. Sure, fun if maybe we were all adults.
Yeah.
But made me feel a little gross.
Fair. Yeah, I would say the same. I was like, oh, you are children.
but if you can get away with that, then like maybe look into a different show.
Yeah.
Right? Or did we...
Says the actor who was on lingerie at 17, right?
Yeah, but now at 32, I would never ask a kid to do that.
Yeah, I know.
So perspective is everything.
Yep.
I was more covered than those girls were.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
That's saying something.
Yeah, no, it was definitely meant to be lingerie, but it was like, it was a long skirt. Like almost to my knees, I think. It was black and like silky. I remember I had to wear a black bra with it because it was really low cut. And so it like blended that I was more covered that way.
Mm-hmm.
But Yeah, like I definitely did not meet dress code, but nothing was hanging out or anything.
Okay.
Anyway, stuff that we were subjected to as teenagers. I don't know if you were. I was part of that group that was like, well, you already said this costume was okay, so now you're wearing it.
For me, it was a little different. It was more having to do with like content and like consent. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, it was just like, yeah, you kiss, so now kiss.
Yeah. It was more like that. I was forced to do that.
You have to kiss each other, so why don't you go practice? Did you ever get one of those?
I never got one of those. Though the one incident I can think of specifically was there was a play where the director had picked it and cast it and everything, but apparently did not finish reading the whole script before she cast it. Because she only read act one, and she was like, oh yeah, don't worry, there's no kissing or anything in it. And then act two, there's a huge scene where like all these people drink this love potion and just start making out with each other, like across the whole stage. And I was like, or like chasing each other around trying to kiss them. At the time, I remember feeling me at the time, I was like, I'm probably fine with this. But there were definitely people in the cast who were not okay with it.
Yeah, exactly. And if you are not okay with it, it's like, well, get over it. If you want to be an actor, this is what you have to do.
Yeah.
And if you want to set that boundary for yourself, then you're difficult and you'll be blacklisted.
Right.
And so it was just like, do whatever someone tells you to do.
Yeah. Thankfully, that has changed now. That is totally different now, and that's good.
And I'm not, like, to be fair, I'm not opposed to doing something like that. Like, if we had the right bunch of kids come along and everyone has to drink a love potion and chase each other across the stage, like, we could maybe figure out how to make that work. But, man, I wonder how much, like, this goes hand in hand with me or in my brain of, like, the anxiety pandemic. It's like, I'm anxious. I can't perform this scene in front of the class. Can I just send you a video instead? Like, no, you have to perform this scene in front of, like, you have to do your monologue in front of the class.
Yeah.
At least once. And then if you want to read, but like everyone being anxious, like I have anxiety too, but also I was forced to do way worse stuff than anyone's ever going to ask you to do on stage in our school. So I don't know, like how much of the resilience in kids is crushed because of things like setting boundaries? Like, cause I don't know, I'm having these thoughts and this doesn't relate to White Christmas at all.
No, but it's okay. I think it's an interesting discussion. This
discussion about like giving kids the freedom to like consent to things or not, like things, any kind of like intimacy on stage, like hand holding or like partner dancing. That kind of stuff, when it's like you're not old enough to give consent legally, but also like teaching about, as an educator, I feel like it's my responsibility to help teach that stuff. Like, consent is freely given and freely revoked. And if you don't feel like you can say no, then it's not consent anymore.
Right.
That I'm forcing you. Like, and even we're just talking about like stage kissing and hold hands with your scene partner, that kind of stuff. But like, I do think allowing people to have boundaries like that is important, but I wonder how much of like giving kids that kind of freedom has also made them scared to try anything.
Yeah, I think you bring up a fair point as well with that. I do think that there are definitely students who feel that way as far as like, well, if I don't want to do it, then I don't have to do it. Like, but there's, I feel like there's an asterisk there, like to an extent, because I mean, granted, you are their teacher. You are there to help them, you know. Just because a kid has stage fright does not mean that they don't have to do it, right? But you're never going to force them to, essentially, for lack of a better term, have an intimate scene with a classmate. You're not going to force that.
No, in a classroom setting, like, I basically just set the rule that's like, you're not allowed to touch each other. Like, full stop. You're not allowed to touch each other. And if like they write 10-minute plays in my theater one class, if you can't figure out how to do this moment without touching each other, then don't do the moment. Write something else. Like, they write plays based on fairy tales, like, and fairy tales that I have pre-screened. So it's like, what could you possibly, what could you possibly be doing where you need to touch each other. Like, and like, certainly no one will be punching each other, like any kind of stage combat or any kind of kissing or any of that.
Yeah.
Right. So in a classroom setting, that's off the table, but in an after school play or musical setting, sometimes that's in the script. And actually one show of the five, well, I mean, I guess if you count all together now, so 2 out of 6 did not have any kind of stage kissing. Every other show has had it. And like, I am usually, I think I've disclosed all of it in character descriptions to be like, hey, these two characters have to kiss in the script. And it's not like a, we can get around it.
Yeah. Can't do like a handshake.
Yeah. When the line is, may I kiss you? It can't be a handshake. It has to be a kiss.
How about a high five?
If you're, well, in rehearsal, we do high fives until we've blocked it to the point where we can do it with an audience. But I don't know. That's something I've been thinking about a lot. It's like, what's the line between like consent and actors being allowed to set boundaries for themselves and directors accommodating that? Like, at what point do I have to not accommodate, or do I not have to accommodate that anymore? Right. Because if I'm like, well, it's a non-negotiable, Anna and Kristoff have to kiss at the end because the line is, may I kiss you? So if you're not okay with kissing someone, and when I say kissing someone, you don't know who that person's going to be yet.
Right.
If you're not okay with kissing every single person who could be in this cast, or stage kissing them, because we don't actually do real kissing.
Right.
We always fake it around these parts. If you're not okay with that, then like, what point do I have to accommodate that? I don't know. I don't think I'm unreasonable as a director usually. And I feel like I'm like relatively accommodating for the kids, but the principle of the thing, like, I don't want to be the, well, I had to suffer, so now you have to suffer kind of person. I feel like that's what we got when we were coming up from the generations before us, but the culture has shifted more to like, this is what I had to endure and I don't want you to have to endure it. Well, this was an interesting tangent.
Yeah.
For White Christmas.
Speaking of tangents.
Do you have other major talking points?
Not really. I mean, I like the show. I think it's fun. It's a show, I mean, a Christmas movie I enjoy watching. Maybe not every year, but enough, you know. I definitely watch it more than Holiday Inn.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, is how do you feel about this compared to the other Irving Berlin shows, and we can say movie musicals or stage musicals?
I honestly don't know if I know all of them, because I know, like, you mentioned a couple of like the reviews, but as far as like, I don't know what all of the shows are offhand.
Well, I was thinking, like, if you're, as a director or producer, if you're choosing to do an Irving Berlin show because you want to do an Irving Berlin show, probably it's this or Annie Get Your Gun.
Oh, okay. Sure.
Right? Yeah. But like, but basically any Irving Berlin show is going to have the song recognition and like the old school appeal. But those are the two titles that have the name recognition. Because like, nobody knows The Melody Lingers On is an Irving Berlin song.
Right.
In fact, I think it's confusing because The Melody Lingers On is a lyric in a Gershwin song.
Yeah.
As well. It's in They Can't Take That Away From Me.
Gotcha. Yeah, I was... Yeah, go ahead.
No, it's in an Irving Berlin song too, but that comes from Irving Berlin's daughter's biography of him.
Okay.
But anyway, I think I prefer Holiday Inn to White Christmas.
Tell me more about that.
I think the plot's a little bit better and it has more appeal outside of the Christmas season.
That makes sense.
I think it's got more of the big Irving Berlin songs, and it's got more, it's honestly, it's like a better version of that story. Because it's kind of the same thing. It's
kind of the same story.
They find this old venue and it's going under. And what if we just took all the actors when they were out of work on holiday and we put on a show for every holiday? Because Irving Berlin has a song for every holiday.
Right.
Holiday Inn. And like, they're so similar. But White Christmas has the name recognition going for it.
Yeah.
So like, I guess if you're a director, your choices are Annie Get Your Gun or White Christmas. But personally, I like Holiday Inn better.
Okay.
Especially like comparing stage versions.
For sure. I have not seen the stage version of Holiday Inn. I'm assuming it's a lot different than the movie.
There's a pro shoot. It's so good. It's got what's his face from Gentleman's Guide. And
oh, Bryce Pinkman?
Yes, and Corbin Blue is in it.
Oh, okay, yeah, I'll have to check that one out.
It's on Broadway HD and Digital Theater Plus. Have you not seen it? That's just irresponsible.
I just haven't seen it.
That's
irresponsible. I need to
check it
out.
Of you.
I'll do that.
I shouldn't be surprised.
Probably not.
You haven't seen Les Mis or Phantom or Wicked, so why would you have
not,
seen Holiday
not
Inn?
Live. You're right. Yeah. Quick tangent, talking if I can talk about Holiday Inn. I remember I was dating a girl and she said this was like one of her favorite musicals. She's the one that also introduced me to White Christmas, but she introduced me to this one first. She's like, oh, it's so great. You're going to love it. It's an old musical. Blah, blah, blah. Okay, great. I did not expect blackface and I was very taken aback.
Oh,
because
yeah.
That just, there's no warning. It's just bam, blackface. And I was like, oh, okay. And I had to like do a little bit of mental gymnastics to try to like put myself in like, okay, this was the 40s. Da, da, da. And so threw me off.
I always forget that that's in the movie.
It is in the movie. It's not in the stage show.
Yeah.
But I think that is personally why, for me, I like White Christmas just a little bit better, because it doesn't have that problem. But I understand what you're talking about as far as like, yeah, it's not so specific to just one holiday. It's more holiday. It casts a wider net, so to speak.
How could we include God Bless America and Easter Parade? I know.
Holiday Inn.
Irving Berlin, do you think you can crank out a couple more holiday related songs? And he said, hold my beer.
What's the Thanksgiving song?
Jingle Bells. I don't know. That's my fun fact. Jingle Bells is a Thanksgiving song.
It is a Thanksgiving song. You're right.
I do have a soft spot for Call Me Madam, but.
Oh, do you?
Again, I was even in this horrible Irving Berlin review and I still really like fell in love with all of his music. So well, I think that just goes to show you how great he is.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair.
Okay. In an educational theater context, do you feel like this show works, or like, is it worth doing? So A, does it work? B, is it worth doing? C, would you ever do it?
So on a personal note, I don't love holiday specific musicals anyway, because I feel like it limits your ability to do it because, you know, like, for example, we do our musicals in the spring. I would feel really weird doing a show about Christmas in the spring. But I think that's just me being picky. I don't think that's necessarily has anything to do with the content or whether or not it's viable for a high school theater program to do. I think it can be done in high school, but I think that you have to really make the kids understand the content and context as opposed to just handing them out a script and letting them do it. Because, like, you know, you and I talked about the high school production that we did watch and like how a lot of the jokes didn't land. Like, okay, well, I feel like if you're able to, or if you have the kids that are able to present the maturity that these actors, characters need to present, then I think it'd be fine to do in high school, at the high school level. Would I do it? Yes, I would do it. I don't have a problem doing this show at all. It has a lot of really big dance numbers in it, which would be something new for us because we've done shows that have dance numbers, but not nothing that's like been huge like this show has. Like Blue Skies, I Love a Piano, and what was the other one? There's another one that's like really, really big, a huge dance number. It's
I've Got My Love to Keep Me Warm.
I think so. I think that's it. Yeah, there's just a good handful of like really long dance numbers in the stage version. And I think that as long as you've got the kids to do it, you can do it. But I think that this is is more well suited to a program that can produce a musical at any time of year and not just in like a specific time frame. Because like if we were to switch our shows and do the musical in the fall, I'd be more akin to doing it because it's closer to the holiday season. But with our musicals being in the spring, I would still do it if you really wanted to do it. But like I have a hard time listening to Christmas music outside of December. Personally. Granted, the only Christmas songs in the show are Happy Holiday and White Christmas. So
yeah, I mostly agree with you. I feel like the pros of doing the show is that it's got the name recognition, so therefore audience interest. It's a familiar property. There's a lot of recognizable songs. The big dance opportunities, I think that's a pro. I mean, it's a challenge, but for me, that's a fun challenge,
mm-hmm.
and a way to keep growing our program and like growing the skills in the students, particularly the tap opportunities, which is rare and fun high school.
There's so many.
And that's my dream, is to do a tap show. I try to like work a tap number in wherever I can, and I haven't been able to do it in a hot minute, and so I'm really excited to do it a little bit this year. But I would love to do a big tap show sometime. As far as like vocal ranges, there's not really anything insane. And I think that's because it's old.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's pretty low. Like a lot of the time, the concern is that things are going to be too high, especially for the male roles. But also like some more modern stuff has a lot of demanding female vocals that are maybe just out of reach for high school kids, just developmentally. So there's nothing there. And there's also limited male singing roles. Like there's two guys who have to sing really well, and then one other guy who sings a solo, right? And that's about it. I guess the snoring guy on the train sings a little bit in whatever that song is, Snow.
I feel like that's another kind of con for this show, is that the ensemble cast, for me, it's very similar to like when we did Cinderella, because it's like you have the kind of main core of characters, and then the ensemble doesn't really do much outside of like big group numbers.
Yeah, that's on my cons list too, is that there's only 5 Jimmy eligible roles. And while that's not a deciding factor for me,
mm-hmm.
if it's something you're thinking about, like there are multiple shows that have 10 Jimmy eligible roles. And so to only have 5, it's Bob, Phil, Betty, Judy, Martha.
Mm-hmm.
And of those 5, it's the male roles that carry the show. And knowing that in educational theater, the vast majority of us have more girls than boys. And the boys we do have could be hit or miss. And I say we as like the collective, because we are lucky that we've got really strong, like I was making this joke at school the other day. Like you have to be unreasonably talented at our school to get a lead role.
Mm-hmm.
And there are tons of kids who auditioned for us this year. We had more kids audition than we've ever had before. They're like tons of kids who auditioned who had a fine audition and in fact improved a lot from last year, who did not get cast because I can't take everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're lucky in that instance, but I know there are lots of places where people are like, hi, I have no boys who can sing. What musical can I do?
Yeah.
And, yeah, so if that's you, maybe not White Christmas, because the boys carry that show, and there's not a lot of featured ensemble roles. There's lots of dancing, which is great, but you're not going to get a lot of opportunities to really feature individual kids besides the core cast of characters. The other con, and this could be a pro or a con depending on how you want to look at it, but the orchestrations are for a big band orchestra.
Yeah.
And that's challenging for kids depending on your program. I personally think that our program could handle something like this, but again, we're at a big school with a lot of talent, so we're in a different situation than other people. Would I ever do it? Sure. I'd also probably want to do it during the fall.
Mm-hmm.
If we're in that spring musical slot, Holiday Inn feels more seasonally appropriate, but also like whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's high school. Do I care that much? It's not that much Christmas music.
Yeah. I mean, it's comparing this to something like, I don't know, Elf, the musical.
Right.
Which leans so heavily into the Christmassy stuff that like I would be more comfortable with doing White Christmas than doing Elf or like How the Grinch Stole Christmas, the musical, or whatever you want to call it. Like, I wouldn't want to do that one anyway, because we've done Seussical already. So also, I just have problems with that show. Maybe next year we'll talk about it.
Oh, God.
But yeah, I mean, yeah, I don't disagree with you, and like especially in the cons, but you're right about the boys carrying that show. They have to.
The sisters don't even come in for, if I had to guess without knowing the script, I would guess that they come in scene 5, like a good chunk of the way through act 1.
We get one, two, three, four songs before the girls are introduced at all.
So
they get introduced during Love and the Weather.
Okay, so maybe it's a little earlier on stage, but still, like, they're on and off and on and off so much, and it's just Bing Crosby and Danny Kaye, whose character names I can't remember. Bob and Phil. Philly Dilly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if, I mean, like most things, if the right bunch of kids came along, then sure. I'm not itching to do the show, and in fact, if we were really thinking about an Irving Berlin show, I think I would push for Holiday Inn over the other ones.
This one?
Yeah, I mean, I don't, they, like, again, as a program where we're like, okay, why are we choosing Irving Berlin? Is it because it's Irving Berlin? Or, you know, to have the name recognition of Irving Berlin? Or is it to try to expose kids to a different genre of musical theater? Like, what's the purpose?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just, as a teacher in a public school in 2025, a show that so heavily features guns scares me.
Fair.
So Annie Get Your Gun is not one that I'm trying to do maybe ever, just because I honestly, I'm scared to have a bunch of gun props around.
That's very fair.
That's the only reason. Like, I don't love Annie Get Your Gun, but I don't love all the shows that I've done. So it's a good show. People know it. It's got a bunch of songs that everyone knows and loves. So I think it would be this or Holiday Inn would be the ones I would want to do.
I mean, unless we wanted to try to throw in a musical review somewhere at some point.
I would also really like to do like a district-wide
musical review.
We could get, we get every school to take on a couple songs and take on more the higher
well, we
you
have,
are.
I mean, we have done it once.
We did, but there are, I think there's 48 songs in I Love a Piano. If I remember correctly, it's 48, which is a lot. So
that is a lot.
A full company opening and closing and probably a couple other things. And then, as the high school, we would have to take on more work than, like, I don't know, how low would we go? Would we go to the junior high? We go to the middle school? We go to the elementary school? Like, how far do we go? Hey, if you want to do it, let's do it sometime. I think that would be fun. And a review like I Love a Piano is the way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
If we're going to do a, like, a district-wide show.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
I love Irving Berlin. I would direct that. Okay, we haven't done this in a minute. Do you have a dream cast?
I honestly didn't even really think about it, but I can definitely come up with one as I'm sitting here.
Okay. I have two. I have the stage cast, and then I have the film cast.
Like if they remade the film?
Yeah.
Okay.
Which would you like first?
I would love for you to give me... Let's do the stage first.
Okay.
Stage version
stage
first.
Stage cast. And it's not perfect. Usually I try to think of people exactly as they are at the time of recording, and it's not perfect, and I refuse to change it. My dream Bob is Jonathan Groff, of course.
Oh, of course.
Of course.
Of course.
And if Jonathan... I also think Jonathan Groff could make a good Phil, but I couldn't think of another Bob, so it's just Jonathan Groff. My Phil is, rest in peace, Gavin Creel.
Ugh. Yeah.
Can you imagine Jonathan Groff and Gavin Creel together?
That would have been so fun.
Delicious.
Yeah.
And because we just saw Merrily, my Betty is Lindsay Mendez. Because I need Jonathan Groff and Lindsay Mendez to be together again. And then I was trying to think of someone to put against Lindsay Mendez. So my Judy is Ariana DeBose.
Oh, okay.
I need a dancer who could play with Lindsay Mendez. And then my Martha is Stephanie J. Block.
Fun.
I didn't want to go like Bernadette Peters or Patti LuPone.
Yeah.
I didn't want to go too old, but I did think of that.
Yeah, that's fair. Okay. Yeah, that works. See, can I think of one? I'm trying not to skew, like, we've done so many shows where we've skewed so much younger as far as cast wise. These are like full adults.
I know. Well, and I was also watching,
I'm trying to think
like
of older people.
Let's assume on the, if it's 1954 and they were serving in the military in 1944, on the high side, we can assume that they were like 22, which means they're 32.
Oh, sure.
But watching it's like, man, people looked old.
Yeah. Yeah.
They looked so old. So I was trying to pick full adults.
Yeah. Full adult people.
Like 30s at the minimum.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I know Brian D'Arcy James has already done it, but I want him to do it again.
Yeah.
Just have him play Bob again. I love Brian D'Arcy James. I'll watch him in anything. Trying to think of Anyone else? I feel like as much as you're probably going to hate it, I feel like Matthew Morrison could probably do
I'm not going to dignify that with a response. I hate that so much.
Oh, wait, what about James Marsden?
Does he sing?
Yeah, he sings in Hairspray. He's
Oh
Corny
yeah,
Collins in
he's in
Hairspray.
Hairspray.
I think John Marsden has the chops to do it. I think he could do it.
I think he's charming, but I think he's a different kind of charming. And I'm trying to figure out why I don't like him in either of those roles, 'cause I can't think of a good reason. But I
Okay. All right. Whatever. All
don't.
right. Well, what about your tell me your if they were to remake the movie,
All
who's your
right,
movie
my
cast?
film cast. This isn't quite perfect on age, but that's okay. My Bob is Seth MacFarlane.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
My Phil is Neil Patrick Harris.
Okay.
You hate all of these.
No, I'm enjoying myself. This is fun.
My Betty is Rashida Jones.
Okay. All right.
My Judy is Jane Krakowski.
Oh, yeah.
And my
Okay.
Martha is Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Yeah, Jane Krakowski is older for sure. So I think Judy's supposed to be the younger sister.
I don't know. I needed someone who could sing and dance.
Yeah, that's fair. Rashida Jones, can she sing?
Yeah, she's a singer.
Oh, okay.
Like, I think before she was an actor, she was a singer.
Oh, okay. Well, great. Great. Yeah, I didn't really know that. I was like, I don't know of a ton of like Broadway act like movie actors who can also sing really well.
I spent an embarrassingly long time doing
Like
Google searches
researching.
for like 40-something female actors who sing. And scrolling lists, and all of them were like Meryl Streep. Like, Meryl Streep is 70.
Yeah.
Streep does not count as middle age anymore. I don't care
Right.
how amazing she looks. She needs to be playing grandma roles now. It's okay.
She's an elderly woman. It's okay. What about Emily Blunt? Can Emily Blunt do it?
Oh yeah. Wait, is she a Betty or a Judy?
From in my head, she's a Betty.
Okay, yeah, agreed.
Yeah.
It's funny you say Emily Blunt because I did also think of Anne Hathaway,
Oh yeah,
but I
Anne Hathaway.
wasn't sure which role. I don't know how much she's a dancer.
Yeah, I don't know. Is there a dancer right now who is like well known as being like a dancer but also a singer?
I mean, I don't know that Julianne Hough is old enough for me. I mean, I guess she's older than we are, question mark?
Yeah, well, let's look. Let's ask
Let's
Dr. Google.
ask the internet. I mean, I guess she was in Grease Live. Unless you're gonna go like
She was also
the pop star route.
right. She was also in Rock of Ages when they did that movie version of Rock of
I've
Ages.
repressed that memory.
She's 37.
Okay.
So she's around my age,
I
older
guess,
than you.
well, most people are.
Yeah. She's a year
That's.
older than me. She could do it.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess part of my thinking in the casting, and this is a silly thing to think, but like again, watching the movie, I'm like, man, people aged horribly in the 50s. It's like Bing Crosby looks so old.
You're all right. He does look old.
And like he was, but
Yeah.
millennials and younger do not age the same way
Yeah.
that the silent generation aged. Bing Crosby's so old in this movie.
Yeah.
So I guess like part of my brain is like, well, we have to cast old people. Even though there's multiple lines in the script that are like, you're young, don't you? You're gonna want to give this up at some point.
Yeah.
Don't you want to settle down and get married? And again, we're assuming that on the young side, the guys are like 30,
Right.
and it's kind of implied that the girls are younger than them.
That's true.
So, but I stand by it. I want Lindsay Mendez in everything.
To be clear, I just did the math. Bing Crosby was 51 when White Christmas happened.
Ah, well, there you go. He still looked horrible
Yeah.
for 30.
For 30, yeah. For 30, he definitely looked horrible. Oh, I'm doing the math real quick on Rosemary Clooney. Okay, so Bing Crosby was 51, Rosemary Clooney was 26.
Half plus seven producers. F plus 7. And even then, still still pretty icky. Maybe yeah. The conversation about consent was worth it.
Maybe.
He was twice her age. Almost.
Yep.
Gross.
Yep.
But also, they look... How old was Vera Ellen? Because Rosemary Clooney looks older than 26 to me.
I agree. She does look older than 26. Vera Ellen was 33.
Okay.
At the time. Man, she died pretty young, too. Sorry. Vera Ellen died when she was 60. It's pretty young.
Yeah.
And she was 5'4". Like most dancers, very tiny. Tiny little person. No, I don't have anything else. That's all I had. But yeah, now I want to see Julianne Hough and Emily Blunt.
Sing sisters.
That'd be fun. That song also, very funny. That's a great song. I love it a lot. I could see me and my friend Cody singing that song just for fun.
To sing Sisters?
Yeah, me and yeah. Cody. Be very funny.
Oh, you know, this is just a random little thing. The role of Ezekiel Foster
mm-hmm.
is my favorite role. In that, that's the kind of role that's fun. People will remember. They will, like, talk about, oh, yeah, I remember, like, he was so good in that role. But that's the role that you cast, like, the chattiest kid in. To be like, go yeah. away. Stop talking to me. Go practice being slow and quiet. Which, according to Concord Theatricals, can be double cast with the role of Snoring Man.
Oh, well, sure.
And then there's also a character called Mrs. Snoring Man. Which can be double cast with the role of Seamstress.
Well, there you go.
Well, that's curtains for us here at the Greatest Show Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. If you want to share your thoughts with us about White Christmas, you can reach us on social media at Greatest Show Pod. Tell us if you like the show, if you hate the show, movie versus musical. If you had to produce an Irving Berlin musical right now, which one would you pick? At Greatest Show Pod. Slide into our DMs. Or you can send us an email at thegreatestshowpodcast@gmail.com.
It's always there.
It's there. No one ever emails us, but yep. You could email us. If you're enjoying the show, please leave us a rating or review or tell your friends about us. It's fun when people listen.
Yes, please. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to know people out there that are listening. I've had a couple discussions with people over like Discord and things like that who were like, hey, are you this guy? I'm like, yeah.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Usually I just get students go, hey, Mr. Ramon, so I was listening to your podcast.
It's the Greatest Show, Man. It's produced by Brantley Wheeler and Emily Chavone. Our theme song is by the incredibly talented Patrick Duffy. Links to all his social media in the episode description. You can find us on all the socials at Greatest Show Pod. Tweet at Emily and tell her why her opinions are bad and she should feel bad. If you have any suggestions for a musical we should cover in the future, send us an email at thegreatestshowpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you on the next one.
At least we didn't have to bleep out the word asshole 5,000 times in this episode.
Except for Jim. He was a real asshole. Asshole, asshole, asshole.
You're editing this one, so I don't care.
Jim is an asshole. There's your end tag. Beep, 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 beep. I just want to sing parody versions of every Irving Berlin song, but change the words to be about assholes. I'm dreaming of a white hole.
Nothing but holes.
Do I see? Holes. Holes. There were never such devoted holes.